You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Hello, I'm Richard Moore, and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we are not with Daniel Freeb for reasons that will become clear very soon. But before we explain that, let me just tell you a little bit about tonight's podcast. It's a slightly different one. We're going to be looking back on Stage 4. We're going to be looking ahead to Stage 5. But we're also going to be spending a lot of time hearing from Dave Brailsford, who Lionel and I interviewed on the eve of the Tour de France, spent about 45 minutes with the principal of Team Sky, who looked ahead to the Tour, addressed some recent controversies involving TUEs and whether or not, and why Team Sky are not members of the Movement for Credible Cycling. We spoke about all manner of things, about his team selection. It's a fascinating interview that we hope you enjoy, and that will come up in the final part of today's podcast.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
No, Daniel. Although we'll be speaking to Daniel in a few moments, but a bit of a misadventure, a bit of a mishap today, Lionel. So I'm going to start by asking you, where aren't we?
Well, we're certainly not at the Tour de France at the moment. We've come straight to our hotel, which is more of a farmhouse B&B in the Flanders countryside, about 3 miles from the Kemmelberg, which is a famous hill in the Gent-Wevelgem Spring Classic. We are here because tomorrow's stage starts in Ypres, which is about 6 miles away. And today we missed it all because of the problem on the Channel Tunnel. There was an electrical fault on a train on Monday, causing 6 hour delays. We thought we were being very clever by staying at Maidstone Services on Monday night, thinking, yeah, we'll get up in the morning, we'll just get across, all the problems will be solved. All it meant was that we had our 6 hour queue to get on the Channel Tunnel in the morning on Tuesday. So we arrived in France just in time to stop in a little cafe and watch the finish of the fourth stage on the television in there.
We rescued Calamity, I think, by getting there. We were on French soil to watch the finish of the stage today, and we saw Marcel Kittel win his third stage. This one, the most difficult of the three so far, by a long way. He seemed to lose his train in the final kilometre or so. He certainly lost his lead-out man and had to improvise a little bit. Alexander Christophe, the Katusha rider, took a bit of a flyer, and it looked like he had the stage. He was at least a length clear of Kittel, but Kittel was really suffering. We could see from the expression on his face he was suffering, mouth open, but he just got it back, didn't have time to celebrate. But a third stage win for him proved that he's the dominant sprinter. The stage was also notable for a crash by Chris Froome very early in the stage. He was pretty bashed up. It happened right at the front of the bunch, safest place to be theoretically, but there was a touch of wheels, down he went. He's off for an x-ray tonight. We gather that there's no broken bones, but it was a nasty crash on perhaps the worst possible day, because tomorrow's stage, Wednesday's stage, is of course the one that everybody's been talking about for a long time. It's the mini Paris-Roubaix stage over the pavé, 9 sections of pavé. It's a stage that everybody's been nervous about, apprehensive about, all the teams have been preparing for. And we're going to go to Daniel, who did make it to the finish in Lille today. And he was on the finish line speaking to some riders and team directors about their preparations for the Stage 5. Over to you, Daniel.
Yes, Rich, as you can imagine, at the finish today, thoughts were already turning ahead to tomorrow's stage, the prospect of bad weather looming over everyone's head, everyone quite concerned about the likelihood of rain tomorrow. I've been speaking quite a bit in the last few days to various teams about the sort of provisions they're putting in place for tomorrow's stage. As we see in Paris-Roubaix, everyone pretty much will have guys with spare wheels standing at the roadside on all the cobbled sections. Just done a bit of a straw poll of various teams over the last few days. Team Sky seem to have more people and more wheels than anyone else. As you might expect, they're going to have about 30 spare wheels on the cobbled sections tomorrow. Française des Jeux won't have quite that many, but they're very confident that in Marc Madiot, who's a former Paris-Roubaix winner, their team manager, and Martial Gaillon, another direct sportive who also was a very good Paris-Roubaix rider, they've got enough expertise to know where to place their wheel men, if I can use the expression, That was the title of a recent book about Lance Armstrong. I've actually got an email in front of me, or a list, from a kind of internal list we're very privileged to see, from Astana, which sort of outlines what they're going to be doing on the cobbled sections tomorrow. They're actually going to share cars with AG2R and Cannondale, because not all of the teams have enough team cars to transport the support men that they will need on the cobbled sections tomorrow. And of course, some of the team cars will actually have to drive from one cobbled section quickly to another cobbled section, get out and have their men positioned there in time for the race coming through. So they're not going to have quite as many as Sky, but they certainly also feel that they're very well equipped. But just on Sky, I had quite a long conversation the other day with another former Paris-Roubaix winner, Servais Carnarvon, who is now a direct sportif at Team Sky, and he's very much in charge of operations tomorrow, as you would expect. And he talk to me a little bit about what he expected and what Team Sky have planned.
It's about doing it smart, I think. With Bernie Eisel, we have a guy who did Roubaix maybe more than 10 times, who knows how to be how to get on the right position. And I think that's going to be crucial for most of the teams, but for us as well. And I think as soon as you're on the right position on the cobbles, it will be okay. It's going to be so hard to move up on the cobbles. Imagine riders like Terpstra or Van Marck or Cancellara are on the front, and Froome or Contador, whoever is in 30th position, they will never move up one spot on the cobbles. No one can. So that's going to be crucial. And I think there's going to be like three fights. The first section, then it's like 15k no cobbles. Then you have to fight again. And then you get the last big fight on just after the feature, on section number three. From there, it's positioning most important. So it's going to be a tricky day, for sure.
No, the first two sections are less important because there is room to recover afterwards.
If yeah, but don't forget that the second section, after the second section, it's like 6K. Within this 6K, you have the feature. And then what it looks like now, it's going to be tailwind. So it's going to be 5 minutes, 6 minutes between the two sections. So yeah, and it's going to be lined out for sure on the second section because there's a few corners. And so yeah, I think the second section is already a good position there. It means probably a good position into the final. So I think that's crucial. And in my eyes, everybody can ride the cobbles if you believe in it and if you're not scared.
Even Mikel Nieve?
Yeah, you can, of course, you can maybe not go, he will not go as fast as Cancellara or whoever, technical specialist. But you also have to keep in mind the Quickstep, they will have Kiewatowski. So, yeah, most teams will protect the GC riders. So, if Cancellara goes full gas or whatever, probably it will be in the real final, the last 20k or so. Yeah, you have to believe in it and not be scared, because we have different bikes, different wheels, different tires, so we have the best material for that day, and that makes it so much more comfortable and safer for the guys. So and I saw them riding, Froome and Richie, and looked good. So Richie also looked really solid. It's all about good positioning.
Just last thing, you talked there about the technical aspects of it, the equipment, the wheels, etc. What are you doing in terms of contingency planning? You know, at Paris-Roubaix, you have guys at the side of the road with wheels.
Yep.
How many guys have you got doing that, or what kind of provisions are in place for things like that?
We covered all the sections, and I'm not sure how many people we have, but let's say average we have three or four groups of people on every section.
Wow.
So one team is covering two sections. I think we have 30 sets of wheels on the road.
You should be okay with that.
Yeah, no, we're trying to win the Tour de France, so we don't want to take any risk. And of course, hopefully they don't get a flat tire. But it's also with crashes. When there's a crash, you try to put the people on in a smart way after a corner or whatever, where you know, okay, there's a bigger risk for crashes. So put some people there so they can help immediately and give a wheel or whatever. Because we know from Roubaix, we will be far behind them with the car. So we will probably not change one wheel from the car. It's going to be all from the side of the road.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So there we had surveys Carnarvon sounding pretty optimistic about Team Sky's chances tomorrow. That conversation obviously took place before Chris Froome's crash today. Carnarvon there saying that he believes anyone can ride the pavé, even a sort of pint-sized Spanish climber like Mikel Nieve. That is not a view that is shared by everyone here, and it's certainly not a view that is shared by Orica Greenedge's team manager Matt White, who I spoke to after the finish today, and who sounded like he was quite relishing the carnage that he predicts will unfold tomorrow, particularly if the weather is bad. Here's Matt White talking to me at the finish line. And the difference between the wet and dry, what difference does that make to the tyre pressure and the...
A lot. And the thing is, look, there hasn't been a wet period since 2002. Yeah. And I rode 2001 and 2002 when it was wet, and it's a different bike race.
Yeah.
So I know... Big difference then, I suppose, it was 3 to 5 degrees, which is not going to be cold tomorrow.
Yeah.
But it takes, in the dry Roubaix, maybe there's 20 guys, 15 guys who can win. When it's wet, there's maybe 3 or 4.
Okay.
So that's going to amplify any problems that guys have tomorrow. The guys who have never ridden Paris-Roubaix in the dry, and the first time they get on it is the wet, good luck.
It's
gonna be... It will be a nightmare. If you've never ridden Paris-Roubaix at all, and the first one is in the wet, you're in for a, you have some nightmares tonight.
It's going to be a big pile of Spanish climbers at the back of
it. Well, it's going to be everywhere. Right. It's going to be pandemonium because in the wet, it's another bike race. It's another bike race. It's just so much more dangerous.
What do you think is going to happen at the front? What's the likely scenario? Is it going to be like Terpstra and Cancellara, the real Roubaix guys, going away from the GC guys? Or?
Definitely. Oh, that's what I would expect. There's only a handful of pure classics guys here. But I think if those guys can get through the natural selection of the first couple of sectors, well, then those guys will go away. Yeah, maybe. And look at Contador's team. They're all going to be focused on him. They've got some great classics guys there. Same with Sky. You know, Bernie and Geraint are going to be totally focused on looking after Chris. So when you look at, there's a handful really of classics guys who haven't got a GC rider, and those are the guys who I would expect they're battling out tomorrow. But it will be in many, many groups, especially in the wet. I'm not a big fan of this for tomorrow. And we've got nothing to gain or nothing to lose. Yeah. But no one wants to see someone lose the Tour de France tomorrow, do they? No.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Some fascinating stuff from Daniel there at Service Carnarvon and Matt White. Looking ahead to Wednesday's Stage 5 over the pavé. I think, Lionel, you also spoke briefly to Geraint Thomas about this stage, and he, of course, is a bit of a specialist on the pavé.
I did, but this was a few days ago, obviously before Chris Froome crashed in Tuesday's stage, so we don't quite know how that is going to impact on Team Sky's strategy, but I asked Geraint Thomas, first of all, to think back to 2010 and the last time the Tour de France went over the cobbles. Of course, Geraint Thomas's team leader on that occasion was Bradley Wiggins, but he was given much more of a free role that day. He got into the final selection and sprinted out for victory, losing out narrowly to the Norwegian Tor Hushovd. Okay, Geraint, what will your role be this time when the Tour reaches the cobbles, knowing that you've got obviously the defending champion Chris Froome to try and get across those cobbles as safely as possible?
Well, like you say, trying to get him into the cobbles in the best position, really, because that's the safest part. So me and Bernie will try and shepherd him to the front there, but it's definitely different. You know, when you're racing for yourself, you can go through gaps, maybe take a few more risks than usual, but when you know you've got somebody following you, it's kind of that old sort of like truck and trailer sort of thing. You know, you got to think about the trailer behind, which is Froome. He's obviously a bit leaner than a trailer, but you know what I mean. It's definitely stressful. Everybody wants to be at the front. The corners on the cobbles are going to be an issue. I think a few guys might be a bit keen, like, you know, if they're say 20 back and they're trying to get further up and cornering on cobbles and, you know, gravel and stuff on them, and it's definitely totally different to the road. So you just want to be in as far in front as possible, really. So that's basically what we got to try and do. And if stuff does happen, then when you're on the cobbles, you kind of just got to get to the end of them, and then you reassess and see where everything is, what's happening. So,
Chris isn't exactly a cobble virgin, so to speak. He's done Paris-Roubaix back in the day. How do you assess his technique? Is he quite comfortable on them, do you think?
I think so. I don't think the cobbles we do aren't too bad, really. It's mainly the corners on them and getting on them in a good position. That's the main issues. But yeah, when we rode them, he was fine, you know. Like you say, he rode Paris-Roubaix before. In the recon, he was fine. So, yeah, I think he'll be good.
And lastly, this year, the cobbles are a lot harder, do you think, than they were in 2010? More sections, more 4- and 5-star sections.
They're tougher. They're, like you say, there's more as well. And but I think, you know, it only needs one silly crash from 10th wheel and the whole race is blown to pieces. It's going to be stressful and just about getting there.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
One of the interesting things that Geraint mentioned there was this sort of concept of coupling up with Chris Froome and sort of guiding him over the pavé as if he's a towing a caravan, which is incidentally something that Cohen de Court of the Giant Shimano team talked about in last night's podcast when talking about why John Degenkolb as a kind of almost a pure sprinter is not necessarily the best lead out man to be last in the chain for Marcel Kittel. And I think one of the most fascinating things about stage 5 and the trip over the cobbles is not only the fact that terrible weather is forecast and it could be a real mud bath on the pavé, but also the fact that there are potential stage winners, people like Fabian Cancellara, perhaps Alexander Kristoff, somebody like that from the Katusha team, John Degenkolb himself, who was on the podium in Paris-Roubaix, who won't have a responsibility to Marcel Kittel tomorrow. But the fascinating thing is which of the riders who could win the stage will actually be slightly hamstrung by the fact that they have to look after their GC men. I'm thinking of people like Marcus Burkhardt of BMC Racing, who will be one of the people, along with Greg Van Avermaet, who will be very useful to TJ Van Garderen. Obviously, Geraint Thomas, to what extent will he have to look after Chris Froome? And there are plenty of other examples. So it's going to be a real kind of tactical day as well as a battle for survival.
We've got Nicky Terpstra as well, of course, the winner of Paris-Roubaix this year, who in the absence now of Mark Cavendish will certainly have a free hand. He would have had a free hand anyway, I think, and he's got to be a contender. Arnaud Démare of the Francis Dujou team, I think it should be up. He was looking better in the sprint on Tuesday back in France, so he's looking a bit sharper than he has. I know Daniel has tipped him. So it'd be interesting. Somebody did ask us on Twitter this very question: which of the specialists will be allowed to go for it themselves? Cancellara, of course, has a kind of protective role of Frank Schleck, but I wonder as well with him and also Greg Van Avermaet, just how much they will be shackled to the team leader, given that TJ Van Garderen, you know, is a contender for the top five, perhaps not an overall winner. And I wonder if, you know, just for the day, Van Avermaet might be allowed a bit of freedom. One thing that's worth pointing out, I think, that speaking the other day to Luca Guercellini, the director of the Trek team, he was saying that really we shouldn't perhaps exaggerate just how tough this stage is. This is not Paris-Roubaix. It's not 260 kilometres over 20-odd sections of cobbles. It's a much shorter stage over 9 sections. So let's not get carried away about how tough this stage is for the real specialists, for the overall contenders and the climbers. It's a different matter.
Interviews and analysis. We've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
I think it's probably time to look ahead to our Dave Brailsford interview, which we conducted on the eve of the Tour, Richard. And certainly Chris Froome's crash today does throw into a real sharp focus Team Sky's refusal to have a plan B for the overall, when there was the whole debate about whether Bradley Wiggins should be selected by Team Sky to ride the Tour, either in support of Chris Froome or as a viable option should anything happen to Froome. Team Sky and Brailsford in particular made it fairly clear that they were pretty much plan A only. And of course now Chris Froome, whether the x-ray comes back clear and determines that he hasn't broken anything, he has taken a tumble. And another occasion when he's got sort of scuffs on his skin and taken a big lump out of his shorts, so he's not going to sleep too well. It might be a bit of an uncomfortable night for him, but it does highlight this issue of how Team Sky went about selecting their team for the Tour.
Yeah, before we hear from Dave Brailsford, Lionel, let me just remind everybody that you can subscribe to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, on iTunes. Catch us on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com, where we are blogging daily as well as podcasting. And on Twitter, at cycling_podcast. So Dave Brailsford, we sat down in the Team Sky Hotel on Friday evening, and I started by asking him how he chose the 9 riders in the team and to talk us through each rider's role.
It's quite interesting actually, because selection from a sports management perspective, and I think, you know, with my peers in other sports, whenever we get talking, we nearly always end up talking about selection. And it's one of the most challenging parts of the job, really, and getting it right and getting it wrong, and how do you do it, what's the process, what's the timings. We've set out, you know, 12, 15 years ago with the aim of trying to win. What would it take to win? And that's been the priority when we start. And then you start to work backwards from that in terms of, well, what the, you know, you analyse the demands of the event, you try and figure out what kind of team you need to try and win, and you work back from there. And at times, we've come up against pretty harsh situations. For example, where do you select the national champion for the World Championships? Should the national champion of mountain biking, BMX, etc., should they get an automatic place in the World Championships team? Now, most people would go, yes, they should. However, we looked at what it would take to win at the World Championships and how far from the podium then somebody would be. And if you weren't within a certain distance of the podium, we felt you shouldn't be selected for a World Championships team, which inevitably ended up on occasions where we had a national champion who we felt actually, yes, maybe the national champion of Britain, but wasn't good enough to represent or get selected for the world. It is a challenge, because I think you have a very logical, quite a clinical, what will it take to win process, and you take the emotion out of it, and then you have an emotional component, which, you know, we all feel, and we have certain favourites, and certain people that we like. We'd like to see these people in, we'd like to see that player in, or whatever it may be. But I think my job has been to sit and look at this from a logical point of view, and the single lens that I use to try and address these issues is winning. And sometimes it leads to some difficult choices. Coming back to your point about selecting this particular team, the obvious question is, you know, with Bradley and, you know, two Tour de France winners.
Bradley. So Bradley who?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Bradley and Chris, you know, the question is, why on earth would you not select them? First and foremost, you look at this year's Tour, you look at the profile, you look at current form, and you say, actually, we know in cycling that a lot happens. You know, every race somebody crashes. So somebody will crash tomorrow in the States. Somebody will crash the day after. It's going to happen. We don't know who it will be. We don't know what the impact. So to select a team a long way out in cycling doesn't always stack up. And of course, this time round, we saw, you know, to be fair, I think Sergio Henao would have been in our team had he, you know, stayed upright and be fit. And yet he's had a pretty devastating injury in the Tour of Swiss. Pete Kennock, you know, if he was within a smidgens of being in this team, I think we just wanted to see that final confirmation in the mountains in the last couple of days in Swiss. Unfortunately, he got ill. It didn't happen, and they're the sort of, you know, little margins that you're kind of playing with. But you get to a certain point in time. You then take what you've seen. You talk to them. You use your ears. You talk. You listen. You talk to the coaches. You talk to the riders, and then you use numbers. And you look at evidence, and a lot of the decisions we try to make are evidence-based decisions. If we look at the probability of who is most likely to win the Tour de France, we would say the person with the most probability or most probable chance of competing and winning would be Chris Froome. So, okay, we're going to start with that one. And then we start building a team around Chris. And some of that will be dependent on how many climbing domestiques or climbing lieutenants, if you like, would we like to take. How many guys do we want to take who've got more ability on the flat, the ruler type of riders, and then you decide, actually, do you want to balance your team or weight your team slightly towards more of a climbing type team, or do you want to slightly weight more of a ruler type team? And then you start to think about the probabilities of when would you likely find yourself, if at all, in yellow. And if you do find yourself in yellow, there's a big difference between following another team who's defending a yellow jersey and attacking them than defending a yellow jersey yourself. Would we want to try and maintain the lead of the race all the way, or would you let it go and do some other kind of strategy? And that's quite a key consideration in pulling the team together, because obviously that will then depend on the type of team that you want to pull together. And interestingly, in this year's tour, when you compare it, let's say, to last year's tour, the profile is more challenging, in my opinion, in terms of trying to defend a yellow jersey this year than it was last year. Because you had the first critical part of the race last year, and then there was a couple of days where actually you could catch your breath a little bit. And then off we went again into the very tough stages, and you don't really have that as much this year. So if you were to get the jersey early this year, then it's going to be an enormous ask on the team to be able to carry that all the way through. You know, there's another aspect which is all about keeping options open. If Chris is our out-and-out leader, what you then want is tactical options where you could potentially, if you so wished, use other riders to potentially attack and go on the offensive, which causes a reaction from other people, and then you can hopefully benefit off the back of that. And I think for us, Richie Porte, although he's had a challenging start to the season, you know, got ill, as we know, in Torino, he's come into terrific form, and now I think we'll find that, you know, he's looking good for the for this tour. So could you use Richie as a, you know, as a lieutenant and a part of your tactical game plan? Could you use Geraint Thomas as part of your tactical game plan? Could you use, you know, other people? Could you use Bradley? I think that's what questions people will say, you know. So I think you've got your offensive team that you put together, and then you think about, actually, okay, now then, let's have a think about who's going to carry these guys all the way in this race. And that's where you like to Bernie Eisel, who's not only a great ruler, he's very experienced in the cobbles. He's very experienced, not just riding across the cobbles once you got there is not the greatest issue. The greatest issue is starting in the right position when you hit the cobbles. And I think most people would tell you that Bernie's one of the experts in the peloton of being at the right place at the right time when it really matters. And that's a massive attribute for us to have in the team, and that's one of his key roles. And so he's got this title of road captain. He's confident, he makes good decisions, he's experienced, and so he will, as the race pan out, he will make decisions for the team. So we'll have a game plan in the morning, and of course everybody goes off with a game plan in mind, but of course things happen and that game plan can very quickly go out the window, and then you've got to use discretion. Everybody thinks that the sports director is talking continuously to these riders, and it's a bit like a computer game. Of course it's not, you know. So these guys have to use discretion, they have to make decisions on the road amongst themselves, and Bernie is terrific at that. And one of the most challenging periods of the race, which maybe a lot of the people listening won't recognise as much because it's not seen as much on telly, is actually the morning when the break is forming and getting the right break with the right people in it. And sometimes that can be done in, you know, it'll happen in the first kilometre, some guys go off the road, everybody stops and off they go, they're gone for the day. And yet other days, they can go, you know, they're riding at 50k an hour, 55k an hour, for 60k, you know, for an hour plus before the right break goes. And managing that and managing your effort in defending that or attacking that is crucial. And Bernie's brilliant at that, and so is Abby Zandio. And he's really fantastic at that part of the, you know, part of the race. So Zabby comes into that category as well. He's 37 years old. He's the oldest guy on the team. He's ridden the tour a number of times. He's very experienced, and he's, you know, so he brings that kind of calmness and that assuredness to a team that you need, which a team under pressure, when, you know, when you're really fighting for it, he brings that serenity, if that's the right word. He is a fantastic individual. In terms of just all the lads go and talk to him. If you walk around the hotel at night, you nearly always find that somebody's popped in to see him. So he's like the dad of the team, if you like, you know, and they'll go and talk to him, and then he'll come have a word with us. You know, he's one of those, he's like a link between the management and the riders. Danny Pate equally is in that engine room, if you like. And we felt that Danny this year rode terrifically well, particularly in California. And then in the Dauphiné, he rode really well. He's climbing better than he has. He's a good climber in his own right, but he's actually got that blend of working and climbing really working well for him at the moment. So he's quite versatile, you know. And then we've got Kirienka, who's basically a big engine. So if you need to ride 150k over mid-mountains, tough terrain, you know, he's your man, basically. And he keeps going and going and going. And I think that's the engine room of the team. And then you start looking at the other guys in the team, and then we can't kind of start thinking about their ability to climb. So David Lopez has ridden, I think, every race this year with Chris. They've got a great understanding. They've got a good relationship. And so his role is, again, medium mountains, very experienced, knows when to go hard, knows when to back off a bit, knows when, you know, when they get onto a climb and there's another team's riding a real hard tempo, he knows, he can feel it. They don't panic, you know, they just wait and say, no, we'll keep our tempo. They can't sustain that. Or vice versa, if it's too slow, he'll pick it up, you know. So Geraint is blessed, I think, as being probably one of the most versatile riders in the peloton. He can do pretty much everything, which is a great thing, but also I think it, in some respects, holds him back because, you know, he is so good at everything that he gets asked to do everything. Whereas, you know, I think we would like to see Geraint now focus more on his climbing. And I think given his ability to get through some of the tough mid-mountain stages, like stage two, for example, the cobbles, for example, we feel that in Geraint we've got such a versatile rider who can, you know, be there a lot of the time. And then obviously we've got Mikel Nieve, who's an out-and-out climber. You know, he's not a guy who's looking forward to the cobbles, I can assure you that. And he's settled into the team now. He rode really well in Romandie. He rode really well in Dauphiné, winning the last stage. Again, an experienced rider, and he's in there for that climbing ability, and purely his climbing ability. So he won't be expected to do too much work in those key sort of flat stages. That'll be down to the stronger guys. We'll want Mikel to hold his... Keep his cards close to his chest, you know, and wait until those mountain stages. And then Richie Porte, obviously, when Richie's in good form and going well, he's one of the top few climbers in the world. We know that. And then you have to ask yourself, well, okay, that's the physical side of it. And then, but then you'd have Sergio, you'd have Peter Kennett, Ian Stannard. If he hadn't injured his, you know, fractured his vertebrae, he would have been pretty much a shoo-in, I think. You know, he'd probably be the first name on a team sheet. Bradley, and there are several of Christian Knees. We've got several other riders who could have been in this team. But the next step is to think, okay, this isn't just about a bunch of guys who appear for a couple of hours every afternoon on the telly. This is a bunch of guys you're going to put together, and we're already, you know, been together for nearly a week before the race has started. They eat breakfast together, they share rooms together. They get on a bus. They go on a bus with 9 seats on it together. They race all day together. They come back. They debrief. They race again. You know, they travel, sorry, to the next hotel. You know, in massage, eat together, and that same routine for nearly 4 weeks. And in our experience, after about 10 days, 9 or 10 days, people start to get on each other's nerves. It's like the Big Brother scenario. Yeah, no, you two, classic example. Anyway, I know you're sharing one car at the moment, but I'm sure one of you will be having a lift with us. It's going to happen, isn't it? You know? But you know, and that's what happens. And I think you've got to take that into consideration. And in a great team, when you start to think and break down what's the difference between a group of individuals and a team? And a team is collectively, we all know it's the sum of the parts is greater than the sum of its parts. You know, the outcome is greater than the sum of its parts. Sorry. And a group of individuals is nowhere near as cohesive, and it doesn't quite work as well. So why in sport do we put so much emphasis on team? And we talk about team all the time. In my experience, it's a really hard thing to do. And I've had some brilliant athletes, but relatively few brilliant teams, and I think when you look at that, you've got to take that into consideration. And I think if you've got one guy you think can win this race, and there's not many people who can win this race, you start thinking, okay, well, what if we were to do something which physically wasn't a great cost to us, but could be detrimental in you know, the team, the cohesion, you know, that all of that sort of intangible side of things. You know, if there's the blend and a chemistry and people giving feedback and a whole host of things, if that side doesn't work well, you're kind of working against yourself. It's a bit of an own goal. You don't have to worry, you know, why compete against yourself? You've got to be competing against everybody else and being the best that you can be. And in my experience, you know, it's you can get, I think I love the saying, and it's a bit cheesy, and I know, but sound like a you know, sound bites and all the rest of it, but you know, the star team will always beat a team of stars.
I mean, you're acknowledging there was a risk that having Bradley Wiggins in the team might have upset the apple cart a little bit, or damaged that cohesiveness, well, that you need.
I think the reality is, I think they're both, you know, they're both characters in their own right, and we don't create characters. We try to manage characters, and it's not just. I think we shouldn't just talk about Bradley and Chris. This goes for the entire group, and you've got to piece together a group, because what happens in a situation, the danger is, if you start to get cracks and its cracks start to appear, what then happens is riders will start and staff will start to think, right, I'm on his side or his side, or I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to shut up and say nothing. And if you get to a situation where a great team, whether they like each other or not, but a great team have a certain freedom in terms of being able to give feedback or to call people out or to ask, why did this today, that you were supposed to do this, you didn't do it, what happened? And as soon as you get into an environment where, for whatever reason, it goes quiet, because people don't feel that they just don't feel I can talk, I'll just shut up. I'll sit here, I'll keep my head down for 2 hours on this bus, I'll get off and I'll go and message somebody or whatever, get on the phone. Then all of a sudden you've got problems, And this is the unique thing, I think, about the Tour de France. More unique, in fact, than Olympic Games. Olympic Games, you're together for a long time. But actually in this, you're competing every day for a long time. And it's unique in terms of the challenge that it represents in terms of a cohesive group sticking together and giving their all together and winning together and losing together. And, I think if you have an option where you think, actually, we can create this really cohesive group, or maybe a group which is less cohesive, and that's not the sole reason, but it's a factor, then you're going to go for a cohesive group, and it's as simple as that.
So friction is okay, but division can be fatal for a team. So you can manage friction, I guess.
You get friction. A lot of the, again, it sounds a little bit contradictory, but a lot of the teams, the great teams that I've been part of and been, privileged to be part of, have been quite rough places, really. Because people are pushing them right on. You feel like it's right on the edge of falling over, really, and going wrong, and you just kind of at times thinking, Christ, we're hanging on to this. But ultimately it's because everybody's pushing. But the key thing for me is, people talk about, and I think I've said this before, about this idea of team harmony. You've got to have team harmony, and you do. I mean, it's ideal if you can have that, but ultimately what you really want is this idea of goal harmony, is where every single individual in your team is absolutely clear and totally and utterly committed to a single goal, and they'll do whatever it takes to get it, within the rules, of course. And that's teams. And so my role is to sit down, and as I've got older, I'd like to think that you look at the information in front of you, and you look at all the cards that are dealt to you. And you take that, you take the data, and you take everything else, and then you try and apply what you've got in front of you, the facts, and you add in a little bit of wisdom, and off you go. And that's what I try and do. That's what.
So have you picked a team to defend the yellow jersey for a fortnight, or to keep Chris on the shoulder of somebody until the penultimate day in the time trial?
We'll talk about that in the next podcast. In a couple of weeks' time, shall we?
Yeah. You talk about friction, Dave. We certainly have a lot of friction in our podcast, and we feel that kind of binds us together. You mentioned the rules, and obviously this being the Tour de France, there'll be a lot of discussion over the next few weeks about doping in particular. It's already been on the agenda this year. We had the case with Chris Froome at the Tour de Romandie, not a case of doping clearly, but the TUE. And this, for some people, falls into a grey area, a grey sort of ethical area. Looking back on that, with hindsight, should Chris have ridden the Tour de Romandie, do you think? Do you have any regrets about that? And secondly, what is your kind of policy on TUEs?
Okay, I totally understand, and let's face facts, the reason that this sport talks about doping and et cetera and issues is because obviously it's had a tremendous blow in recent times because of the past of the sport, and it's all been unearthed, and everybody's gone, blimey, I was duped. And of course everybody after that is going to feel very, very suspicious and be very, very careful of, I think a lot of people love the sport and they want to trust and believe in what they're seeing, but they're very cautious because they've been burnt. And so that puts us in a certain situation where we've got to try our absolute best. And I'd remind, everybody that when we started out with this project, our aim was to create a British team to create a great team, to try and win the world's biggest bike race with a British rider and do it clean. And we're trying to do that within 5 years, remember. And what we've done it twice, with two British riders, and we've done it clean. So I don't think there's any issue for me in terms of, you know, am I confident in this team and what we're doing? 100%, absolutely. Do I understand why we get this barrage of questions? And if there's anything which creates any, you know, shadow of doubt, or if there's anything, you know, why we get sort of this tidal wave of questions, of course I understand it. You know, I think I'll be in the same position myself, you know. So you can't prove a negative. And so our job is to continuously talk, continuously try and explain what we do and how we do it, etc., etc., which we're quite comfortable with. And in the specific case of Chris, you know, I think the team doctors have a policy, a written policy, and it's on our Dropbox, and it's constantly updated. With regards to any TUE, two doctors have to say yes. There is a medical condition here which actually needs the appropriate normal medicine to treat this rider. The next step is to then present this to the UCI, and they say yes, we're comfortable with the symptoms, we're comfortable with this, and actually we agree with you that these are the right steps to take. And of course that then is ratified by WADA. The decisions that the teams of doctors there and the medical team took, you know, 100% back our doctors, they do a great job. Do I understand why there was a breach in medical confidentiality? No, I don't. And do I have concerns about how did information, which is medical information, get out of Chris's whereabouts? Any rider, really, not Chris, but that somehow that's leaked out of the system into the media's hands. And I'm not comfortable with that, even though it's nothing, not because there's anything to hide, it's just actually that doesn't feel right to me. It leads to a whole host of other questions. Did we change our policy? No, we didn't change our policy. You know, the policy was there, it's clear. I think there was an interview which was done with Steve Peters, and I know for a fact that Steve Peters, who actually sits on the TUE commission in the UK, he's one of the guys who actually, you know, so he's not, this isn't just some guy who randomly is commenting about TUE. This is a, you know, a guy who's very experienced and knowledgeable and trusted by his peers and within the community, or that community, about his ethics and doing the right thing. And I know for a fact that what they'll say, the medics will say, is what you have to do is you have to have an approach which allows at some point medics to use discretion. Now, it's not operating alone in terms of discretion, but collectively, if you're presented with a set in circumstances, there has to be a degree of discretion in their judgment and expert opinion about what they should do. And I think they should be backed for that. So
it's never been a Team Sky policy to not have guys racing with TUEs? Because that has been reported.
Yeah, it's not a written policy of ours. No.
So you believe TUEs have an appropriate place in professional cycling, even if the perception of the public is that you would look at Chris Froome in the Tour of Romandy, for example, and I had first-hand experience of seeing Rigoberto Urán during the 2011 Dauphiné, when Dr. Richard Freeman went through the process of applying for a TUE for him because he had a bronchial problem and wanted to complete the race in order to earn selection for the Tour de France. And I said to Dr. Freeman, would the appropriate action be to pull the rider out of the race? And he said, well, yeah, that may well be the appropriate action, but he is not going to do that. So as a doctor, what do I do? I have to use the appropriate rules that are in place to get him treatment that he is allowed to have within the rules, because he is going to complete this race no matter what, because he is. So you've got a situation where athletes will want to continue. Chris Froome,
I think there's a difference between, you know, the words to you, and why does that kind of create alarm bells? It's because they've been abused in the past, and that's why we know that actually, you know, Armstrong tested positive. They got a TUE which was backdated, and it was for, you know, corticosteroid cream, if I remember correctly. And actually, you know, that sort of scenario led people to be very, very suspicious about TUEs. In actual fact, if you take that out of the equation for a minute, and you think about all of the other sports, cycling is not the only sport that uses TUE. Every sport uses TUE. Why are they used? They're for the medical care and to treat the health of a rider, and they should be allowed to have the right medicine if they're ill enough, or if there's the symptoms require it for their health, to allow them to either get better and do their job. They're not and should not be used for a performance enhancing purpose. And I think in the past, possibly they were used in a sense, or that it might have been a bit looser in the sense that actually, yes, we'll use this, but actually, you know, there might be a benefit from going down this road. Whereas I don't think that's the case now. I think that there has to be quite stringent, clear understandings about how do you look after the health of a rider, how do you care for the medical health of a rider, and do TUEs have a place in sport? Absolutely, yes, they do, if they are used appropriately. And, you know, WADA and UCI, I think, agree, and they actually vouch for the case that in Chris Froome's case, it was the appropriate action. And had it been another rider other than Chris Froome in that particular scenario, the same action would have been appropriate.
Do you think the spotlight is more intense because Chris Froome won that race, and people think, well, if he was so ill that he needed medicine to start the race or during the race, the perception is that if a rider is that unwell, then they go and win the race. That's where the question marks come from, though, isn't it?
I think you're right. I think it's very, very. You can't, you know, it's a logical kind of line of thinking, and I think you're absolutely right to say that's why people would think, well, how does that work? In actual fact, when you actually look at the scenario on that particular case, and when the medics look at it, and they say, actually, okay, this will help alleviate the medical condition that this rider has. You know, you've got to think then to what extent is that medical condition going to hamper performance, or will it allow them to do the job they're supposed to be able to do? I get it. It's not as if I'm going to sit here and say, well, I don't understand. But I do actually think that applied properly and used in the right way, that there is not only a requirement, but I think a need for TUEs. What we should remember, because I think we're focusing very carefully on a very specific element of TUE use. But if you have a rider, you know, people say, well, we should just tell everybody what TUEs we have. And I think, yeah, we thought quite long and hard about that. But, you know, without going into any details, if you have some pretty personal medical issues, which people do, they're humans after all, and it could be, you know, it could be a very private kind of an illness, or, you know, certainly mental health issues. You know, and if you need to be treated for that, do you want the whole world to know that? Well, I don't think, no, we should. But the good thing about it, I think, is that we should be talking about it. It's not something that should be taboo. I think it should be something on the table. We discuss it, we talk about it. And everybody, you know, we get to a point where everybody understands that actually we are trying to do it the right way, and we are doing it the right way. And I think we need to take on board, if it caused concerns with people, then, you know, you do something, you do it with proper intent, you do it by the rules, you do it 100%. But as you go through and you see how things pan out, we learn all the time. And I think it's that dialogue which is important to have to keep that learning process going.
Dave, the other issue is the Movement for Credible Cycling is a body that includes some teams in the world who are not other teams, and teams who are not members of the Movement for Credible Cycling. Why is that? And is there a reason for Sky not joining up with that?
Yeah, there is, yes. And when we first looked, I actually went to two or three of their meetings, and I sat in and I had a listen and I contributed, and I thought, you know, we had to look at it and sort of want to see what it's all about. And to start with, one of the issues that we had was actually their stance on employing or recruiting people who have had previous doping problems or active involvement in doping. On the one hand, their policy is they can employ anybody with up to a 6 month ban, and ours is we don't want anybody who's had a ban. And obviously that clashes. And so I wrote to Roger Leger and asked him would they change their stance and become, you know, take a similar position, adopt a similar position to ours? No, they wouldn't. Would we change our stance and adopt a similar position to theirs? No, we wouldn't. So that kind of, if you like, that was a bit of an issue. Now, it's an interesting thing, the MPCC. So in far as why on earth is there an MPCC? I think would be the question I'd ask first and foremost. Why do we need a voluntary code? Why is there a voluntary code? And I think the answer is, what we should be looking towards is that fair sport, in my mind, should be where everybody's competing to the same rules, in the same way. Nobody's disadvantaged, nobody's advantaged. We're all doing the same thing and applying it properly in the same way. So then you govern, you know, you police what the rules are. And it seems to me that the obvious and appropriate way of doing that is via WADA to the UCI and via the World Tour license committee that we all signed up to as World Tour teams. And if we're, or if there are teams thinking we should have a stricter code or we should change it, then to me I think what we should be doing and what we'd encourage is we agree we'd all want to be on the same level playing field, but I actually think we should be doing it via the official bodies who govern and regulate the sport and not through some volunteer type organisation that's been created over here. So you know, that's my view. And does it change things? I'm not sure. You know, if you look at the recent situation, we've had three cases of violations before the start of the tour, two of which from MPCC teams. So you know, I think that should be asked as well. And I think if we're talking about, you know, when we talk about things like TUEs and how they're being used, have we asked the MPCC teams how many TUEs they've used and how many have been used? Would the MPCC volunteer that to everybody so we can have a proper stop and a proper look at, across all teams, across all sports, say, actually, let's have a look at exactly where we're at. Then we can better assess the situation on a case-by-case basis. But at the minute, we're taking one or two cases and we're drawing sort of conclusions for the whole sport, and I'm not sure that's giving us necessarily the right view.
I mentioned that you know the doping suspicions is going to be white noise at the tour as it always is, and you've been in the position the last 2 years of having to defend yourself because you've had the guy in the yellow jersey. Does it frustrate you that so much of the focus of these questions is on Team Sky when there are other teams and riders out there who have on the record doping violations against him? Does it frustrate you that you don't seem to be on the moral high ground a lot of the time?
No, I think the reality of the situation, if I'm honest about it, is when we started out, we set ourselves up at such a high, you know, a real high standard, if you like. We came at this with our zero tolerance, and we came at this with a pretty high level view. And I think, you know, by sticking ourselves up there, I think we then have to be responsible for that. So I think had we come in with a lower kind of level of expectation or lower values or whatever else we want to say, you know, if we come in at a lower level, then fair enough, you know, we could be, you know, a bit put out if we got all these challenges all of that. But we didn't. We came in at with a stance which was very anti-doping, very clear. And so anything that occurs that people feel, well, hold on a second, they set themselves such a high standard, you know, we will have to go and ask them. I think that's only fair. And so if anything little, you know, if we waver from that a little bit, then people come at us and go, well, hold on a second, you said this, and rightly so. And I think, you know, it's interesting because in my experience, if you set yourself really high goals or performance challenges, yeah, set the standards high, and you keep pushing people towards it, keep going and aiming towards it, you miss it sometimes, you make mistakes sometimes, we're human, you know, and sometimes you kind of, you look back and think, God, I wish I hadn't done that, I wish I'd never, you know, with Gert Lindes, I wish I'd never employed a guy, it was a mistake. However, I much prefer to try and set the bar as high as possible and try and do everything we can to try and stay there, strive to be there rather than be somewhere else.
Right? Finally, Dave, do you enjoy the tour?
Do I enjoy the Tour de France? I enjoy bike racing, that's for sure, and it's like a hurdle race, isn't it? You know, and I think what the trick is to enjoy it.
Do you enjoy hurdle racing?
Well, no, I think what you do hurdle racing is in a hurdle race. I don't think they're so bothered about the second hurdle, the seventh hurdle, the tenth hurdle, and the, you know, and they're not worried about the hurdles over there. They're worried about the first one that's in front of them and try and get over that one. And then they run a bit, try and get over the next one. And I think if you break it down, I'll worry about the first hurdle or the next hurdle that's coming at me. I think that's the kind of coping strategy, if you like. But
it sounds like a no then. You mentioned worry there, but not enjoyment.
No, do enjoy, you know, when you try and be the best at something, do enjoy Olympic Games, do enjoy big performances. It's a process, it's work, you know, it's your job. And so I stay very, very focused on it. And I do enjoy it. I must say that somewhere, it's not necessarily an enjoyable thing at the moment in time, but I do enjoy it, otherwise I'd stop doing it, you know. And I also enjoy the camaraderie. I love the race, I love the sport. So to be part of the sport's a privilege, you know. If I went around Britain now, we've got the race starting in Britain, I'm sure there'd be millions of people who would love to be, you know, the director of a sports team or a cycling team that's just about to embark on a Tour de France in Britain with a reigning British champion, and you're just about to start out doing that, and you've got a load of people in the country. I'd love that. How lucky is that, bloke? So I think you've got to keep yourself, you know, pretty humble and remind yourself of how lucky you are doing what you're doing. I can remember as a kid looking at this race, and it seemed so inaccessible. It seemed like, you know, I stand at the side of the road, and to be running a team in it is just, you know, it's a great privilege. So yes, I do enjoy it.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.